Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King talks to us about the noise around the so-called nuclear option and what Washington's response to the Zimmerman acquittal is likely to be. Then the father of DJ Henry, killed by a police officer in late 2010, understands better than most what the parents of Trayvon Martin are feeling. He'll talk Trayvon and what he and his family are doing to keep DJ's spirit alive, Marjorie.
Republican Charlie Baker joins us to rate the lineup of would-be Massachusetts Democrats running for governor. The Charles River, did you know? It's clean enough for swimming. You ready for a dip? Then the Boston Globe's Shira Springer joins us to talk Pamplona's insane running of the Bulls and ESPN Magazine's Naked Athletes issue. All I can say is, wow. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
So why did the nuclear option on the filibuster fizzle out, and should we care? Is immigration reform still hanging by a thread? And how will Washington respond to George Zimmerman's acquittal? Joining us to talk through all of that and probably more, CNN's chief national correspondent, that would be John King. Good afternoon, John.
That would be me. Good afternoon. How are you guys?
Hi, great, John. Thanks. We're great. How are you?
I am doing great. Thank you.
Well, I'm dying to know. CNN led the way on the coverage of the Trayvon Martin case. Did a lot of live coverage from the jury. And last night, Anderson Cooper got the first interview with a juror. So was this a big riveting attraction to America? I mean, were the ratings huge for this, John? I would suspect there was a great deal of interest all across the country.
I don't read them every day like I used to when I had a show, but I'm told, and I have seen some of them. I'm not being cute with you. I've seen some of them. I filled in over the weekend, anchored for a couple hours, and I got the ratings. They sent me the ratings from that, and the audiences were much higher than they traditionally are. So there's no question Americans took some interest in this. I know that we were criticized by some people out there for being all Zimmerman all the time. We had a lot of Zimmerman and a lot of the live trial coverage, which clearly people were interested in. We also covered what happened in Egypt very well, I would say better than any other television network, with more people on the ground than any other television network. But cable news, you make a decision like this, you find a compelling story, and I do think it's a compelling story. And I think both the ratings, what I know of them anyway, back that up. And just personally, my first big trial as a journalist was helping cover the Klaus von Bülow retrial back in Rhode Island back in the day. And they're fascinating. And I love this interview with this juror, because when you have a trial like this, and you know it's a very contentious debate in the courtroom, you always want to find out what the jurors are doing, because they're sort of the secret sanctum, if you will. And so having this juror describe, you know, we had one murder vote and two manslaughter votes, and then we ended up not guilty, I think that is fascinating. I think, you know, novels are written about stuff like this, so I think it's a great part of our coverage after the trial to try to pull back that curtain.
Well, speaking of novels, nonfiction books are written about trials. Klaus von Bülow, we spoke to Alan Dershowitz yesterday, who said it was a slam dunk not guilty all along. Hey, John, I don't know if this is serendipity, coincidence, whatever it is. Eric Holder, by chance, is speaking just down the road today from where Trayvon Martin was shot and killed at the meeting of the organization that was first to say the Department of Justice has to do something post-acquittal. How much pressure is on Holder and the president to act in this Trayvon Martin situation?
There's a lot of pressure, and the attorney general, I think, has to be careful not to get too far out over his skis, in the sense that, look, you know, as a white American and a white journalist, you can only listen to the experiences of your friends or the experiences of your community, say growing up in Boston at the time of forced busing. We can't understand some of the reactions that African Americans are having here. We can't fully understand them, but we should respect them and we should listen to them, even if we might not agree with them all the time. And so you have an African American president and an African American attorney general with a great deal of pressure from the community in Sanford, Florida, but also from civil rights organizations, civil rights activists and leaders, who say, well, wait a minute. A 17-year-old kid, you know, was coming back from 7-Eleven and he got shot dead, and no one's going to be held accountable for that? That's a legitimate question, and there's understandable outrage and anger. The challenge is going forward here is that the lines for the Justice Department, sort of the rules, if you will, the guidelines for bringing a civil rights case are pretty strict, and you have to have pretty clear-cut evidence. And there's a big question about whether that evidence exists. And so the Attorney General will have the review. And I think the challenge now is to say, you bet, we're going to scrub this thing as closely as we can, and we're going to look in under every nook and cranny to see if we have a case. If the ultimate answer is that they don't think they have a case, then I think there'll be some blowback at the administration.
Well, you know, you mentioned the different perspective of Black America and white America. Deval Patrick, of course, a Black guy, our governor here, had a great quote today. Says, it's a chilling thought you can be in a neighborhood out buying soda and a pack of Skittles and have your life taken away by someone who just thinks you don't look like you belong there. And yet, John came from CNN. When you guys had the juror on, the exclusive, the first interview with the juror last night, she said race never came up. I find that just amazing.
Well, in a way, that's refreshing. If the jury went into the room and was just saying, here are the facts as we know them, as we believe them, and they debated. And look, there were facts in dispute. One of the hard parts here is there were no eyewitnesses. You know, the neighbors saw sort of, they saw some parts of it. They saw shadows. They heard screams. They weren't sure whose voice it was. You know, two people know exactly what happened here, and one of them, sadly, is dead. And so you had this case where there was a lot of ambiguity, and the prosecution never said that George Zimmerman racially profiled Trayvon Martin. They said he criminally profiled Trayvon Martin. Now, a lot of people took that to mean, you know, wink, nod. He's saying, here's a young Black kid in the neighborhood. He's going to commit a crime. And there was evidence submitted to the jury that of the people who had been found guilty of burglaries and other crimes in that neighborhood, you know, the majority of them, overwhelming majority of them, were African American. So it was sort of brought in a not direct, you know, bulldozer way, if you will. But look, juries do their own thing, and it is both the gift and sometimes the mystery of our system is how juries get to their decisions. But normally, this is where you have the challenge now. Normally, the jury speaks, and whether you agree or disagree, that's the last word. You know, we have double jeopardy. However, there could be a civil suit, a wrongful death suit filed by the family, and now we have the question of whether there's some federal civil rights question at play.
Do you ever sit on a jury, John King?
I have not, I got called recently just after I moved. It's funny, I lived in D.C. for a long time, and I moved from D.C. to Maryland, and of course, the week after I moved, I got called by D.C. I would love to sit on a jury just to get, you know, I've covered a couple of really great, interesting trials, and sat in the courtroom a lot. When I was back in the old days when I was working in Providence and Boston, if there was a slow day, I would just go sit in a courtroom.
Yeah.
Just to soak it up for a little bit.
I love them.
I've been on one jury in a civil case, a slip and fall, and the only thing all six of us agreed on is that we should delay our verdict until after lunch. Beyond that, there was very little agreement. Hey, John, let's move from something that everybody in America cares about to something that virtually nobody cares about except me. This whole nuclear option thing with the filibuster theoretically resolved this morning. Before you tell us what the outcome was, the fix, describe to people what the underlying issue is that has been so contentious.
Well, the underlying issue is, you know, since the guys in wigs got us started on this great experiment that is America, the Senate has had this power where the minority has incredible power to block the will of the majority. And that's set up by design. It's so that the big city, you know, the big cities can't rule the small rural states. It's so that the big money can't overcome the smaller interests. And so there's always been historically this right in the Senate for one senator or a minority of senators to throw themselves in front of the train and stop the train, even if the train has considerable majority support. And it's been controversial from time to time, but all the more so in recent years because it's been used so much more frequently. And, you know, Harry Reid, the Democratic leader now, is screaming the Republicans have done this in an unprecedented way. And guess what? By the numbers, he's right. But the Republicans now are building on the examples back when they were in charge in the early Bush administration, and the Democrats did this too. So unfortunately, the stunt in Washington right now is, okay, when you guys are in charge, you did X. So now that we're in charge, we're going to do 3X.
So
now that we're in the minority, we're going to do 3X. It's become this sort of, you know, outdo the last guy stunt as opposed to do the people's business.
And when we went to bed last night, Harry Reid was saying essentially, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, there are 7 non-judicial nominations, not lifetime appointments. We're not talking about those. Unless there's a straight up or down vote that you Republicans agree to, we're going to do the so-called nuclear option. We're going to change the rules so that other than in judicial settings, lifetime appointment settings, it's a straight up or down vote. Now, one, is that right? And two, what happened to fix this thing this morning?
Yes, that's largely right. That's one of the big areas of dispute. Look, the filibusters now, or the threat of a filibuster, they don't actually filibuster, they just threaten it. So you need 60 votes. It's not actually done. But there are a whole bunch of people, Richard Cordray to head up the old Consumer Protection Bureau that Elizabeth Warren was first part of. And remember, she couldn't get confirmed. Now she's in the Senate. And part of the, and so the Republicans have used this, and look, Democrats have done it in the past. And again, Republicans have used it now, I would say, on steroids to block Obama choices. And some of these are for political reasons, just to say the president wants it, I'm not giving it to him. Some of them are done because they have business on some other issue that they want attention for, so they just block a nominee. But on most of these, National Labor Relations Board, which is part of the compromise, the president's going to pull back two nominees for the National Labor Relations Board and nominate two others instead was part of the compromise. You know, these agencies don't get much attention, but the National Labor Relations Board settles big disputes between employers and their unions. There's a, you know, there was a big one in Boeing in South Carolina not all that long ago, a couple of years back. They don't get a ton of attention, but when they do, they tend to be on big things. This Consumer Protection Bureau is supposed to be a big deal out there, making sure the banks and the, you know, credit card companies don't screw, forgive my language, the little guy. And there's no question Republicans have used this more than their predecessors in the past when the Democrats were in the minority. And so now the deal is that they're going to get an up-and-down vote on those nominees, the non-judicial guys. And the president, in exchange for this, will two National Labor Relations Board people that he appointed, quote-unquote, recess appointments that were in dispute because the Senate wasn't technically in recess. I'm getting into arcane Washington speak, but allegedly the deal is, if it holds, is that we'll get votes on these other nominees. And then they're going to try to use this as the potential building block for a little more kumbaya.
So one last thing on this, John, and this may expose my naivete. Other than lifetime appointments and issues like that, if Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid were sitting in a room with you and you said, gentlemen, you have to be honest or a lightning bolt's going to strike you, what argument is there for there ever to be more than what most of us grew up thinking was a majority, 51 out of 100, on all this other stuff? Why shouldn't there be?
There's no great argument on this if you stay in the lane of this is the president's nominee, the president won the election. It used to be the president gets his guy or his gal, excuse me. You know, president gets his people. He won the election, he gets his people, fair and square, boom. Unless, you know, during the confirmation hearing something, you know, that something financial or some other thing comes up and you say, oh, no, I can't vote for this person. But you vote them down. But that's always been the argument. If you don't like them, then vote them down. Right. Get the votes to vote them down or make your case and lose. It has just become part of the bigger gridlock problem in that since senators have the right, have the power to block the nominees, they do it because they're trying to get, you know, I always joke that, you know, if you don't understand the leader of the unpredictable leader of North Korea, just look at the United States Senate. You know, you've got 100 of them at any moment.
What's they the can joke?
Just be, they can just be. Yeah. What's the joke? Right. At any moment, they can just behave like a 5-year-old to get their way. And that, unfortunately, I'm exaggerating, and I get
not
myself
much,
get a little overly
really.
Comical about it sometimes. But you know, unfortunately, there are enough examples of that that I think that's what the American people think when they look at Congress. And it's not quite that bad. There are a lot of good, well-intentioned people in the House and in the Senate, but they get overshadowed sometimes by the stunt dummies.
We're talking with John King, CNN's chief national correspondent. We have our obligatory weekly check-in on immigration reform, which, of course, is sort of hanging in the balance. But there's this new Gallup poll today, and this isn't shocking, but I think it's more good news for people that do want reform. 48% of Americans, or those polled, believe the Democrats are closer to what they want in immigration reform than the Republicans. Big numbers among blacks and Hispanics. 70% of blacks, 60% of Hispanics, a survey by Gallup, are closer to the Democrats. So does this nudge things any closer, or are we just still, you know, we get the Rand Pauls kind of holding out, the Ted Cruz down in Texas holding out? I mean, just
but that's the Senate. I mean, what's going on in the House?
Yeah,
but the bigger question now is the House, in the sense that you did get, you know, 68 or 69 votes out of the Senate. So, you know, Rand Paul, and to their credit, I'll say this about Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. They didn't try. I mean, they didn't have the votes anyway, but they could have prolonged the debate a little bit. They argued for some things, and then they let the vote happen. So the way the Senate actually dealt with immigration is an example, in my view, of how it should be. You negotiate a little bit, you stall for a couple days, but then you have votes. You have votes, and you see who wins. God forbid we do that in a democracy, right? So now we're over to the House side, and if we do that same experiment, we have votes. Here's what happens. You know, the president's not going to get what he wants in the House. And even Marco Rubio is not going to get what he wants out of the more conservative House. And you're very unlikely. Number one, they don't want to do a big sweeping bill. They want to do a border security bill and a guest worker bill and maybe a path to status bill is possible, but not a path to citizenship. So the question is this. Does the House pass a bill, could be about anything involving immigration, that just becomes the vehicle for an old-style conference committee with the Senate? The Senate appoints its six guys or women, and the House appoints its, you know, six or eight, whatever the numbers are, and they get together and they try to negotiate a big compromise. And then can you get a sweeping bill out of that? So the next step in the House is actually important only if, to the degree that, you know, you might get a tiny bill or very narrowly tailored bill, but if that is the vehicle for a conference, then you still might get something. But look, you have to look at this through the perspective of nationally, the Republicans have a crisis, and they know it. Mitt Romney was below 30% among Latino voters. You know, the words self-deport just keep echoing in the head of a lot of even conservative Latinos who might even agree with Republicans on some of the policy of immigration, but think their tone has been so hostile. A lot of Asians used to be a Republican constituency. They voted huge for President Obama. Why? Because they think Republicans are pushing away, you know, people of color or people who aren't white, to put it bluntly. And so the Republicans have a national crisis, and you can't see them winning the presidency, winning national office, unless they deal with it. However, if you look, go by House district by House district, they have a majority. They were just reelected in a presidential year. They kept their majority when Obama won big. A lot of those guys say it's amnesty, and they won the last election. They think they'll win the next election. Yeah, so if you look at House district by House district, there's not a lot of pressure among only 17 House Republicans go home to districts carried by the president. So only 17 House Republicans go home to places where they think, okay, the voters here, you know, voted for a Democrat for president. Maybe I ought to listen to him, or maybe I need to compromise with him. They don't feel that pressure when you go district by district.
That's an incredible statistic. One last thing on this, though. Unless I'm reading this wrong, the two most powerful Republicans in the House, unless you consider the Tea Party bloc to be the most powerful Republicans, clearly Paul Ryan, obviously former vice presidential candidate, and John Boehner, the Speaker, they want something more comprehensive, don't they? And if I'm right about that, how is it that virtually all the Democrats want it in the House? The two Republican leaders are at least moving in that direction, and it still isn't happening?
That's a great point, because if you look at this, if you look at the sort of the interests at play here, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, the agriculture community, traditionally in rural America, Republican constituencies, they want this. They want this. And so, you know, and Paul Ryan, whether he wants it because there are farms in Wisconsin, or whether he believes it in his heart, or whether he wants to be the presidential nominee, and he knows that if you're on a national ticket, you're doomed unless you start fixing this problem with Latino and other non-white voters. You know, whatever's in their hearts, there are a lot of interests in the Republican Party that want this. They traditionally held a lot more sway. But when a party is out of power and it does not have a singular leader, this is what you get. The splinter groups within the party, whether it's the Tea Party, whether it's the, you know, the amnesty crowd, or a combination of those things. Some amnesty guys are in the Tea Party, others are from somewhere else. That vocal minority can cause problems. And Speaker Boehner's, you know, his hold on the gavel has been threatened from time to time, whether it's the debt ceiling, whether it's the thought of maybe striking a grand bargain with the president on taxes. And so he has to go into this room with, you know, 240 people and look around the room and do the math. And at the moment, he's not willing to embrace a big deal. Does he want one? Yes. He's hoping that some magic comes about. They pass a bill, you know, it gets to a conference committee, something bigger comes back that's more palatable. But at the moment, Boehner has said he will not bring anything to the floor, anything, including the if you've got a potential conference agreement, unless it has the support of a majority of his caucus. I cannot see at this moment, things can change in politics, but at this moment, I cannot see a bill that gives a path to citizenship having a majority support in the House Republican Conference. And so, therefore, you at the moment, you cannot see a bill that meets the president's minimum standard passing the House. So is the president going to take something way below what he wants? I think not, because the pressure will be on the Democrats. Say no. Just let this thing go off the rails and carry the issue into 2014, and if we have to, into 2016, because the issue works for the Democrats.
We're talking with John King from CNN. You know, one last question. John, you are a Dorchester boy, as you've mentioned many times before. I don't suppose you ever went swimming in the Charles River as a young man growing up in Boston, did you?
No, I swam in Dorchester Bay and Tinian Beach and Malibu Beach, and that probably wasn't the smartest thing in the world to do at the time. But we were told to stay out of the Charles River, and, you know, I guess I somehow listened to the authorities on that one. I don't really know why. I was tended to be anti-authority, but never did. But it looks a lot cleaner today than it did then. So if you want to arrange a plunge, let's do it.
Well, I'm not going to do it myself. That's what I was going to ask you. Would you do it? I mean, they're talking about
the first public swim last Saturday since the 1950s.
You have to get permission. You just can't do it any day.
So should we sign you up, John? That's what we want to know.
Absolutely.
I don't think
Although I don't like the permission thing. I just like the idea of, you know, hey, what the hell, you know, it's warm, it's humid, let's go.
If Bill Weld can do it, so can John King. Hey, John King, thanks so much for your time. We'll talk to you next Tuesday.
Let's do it at the river.
Okay.
I don't think so.
I don't know. And they said it was orange and kind of brothy, beefy broth color. I said, I don't know. Anyway, John King, thank you very much. He's CNN's chief national correspondent. We talk to John every Tuesday at 2 o'clock. When we come back, we're going to
1 o'clock also.
What did I say?
2 o'clock.
Oh, noontime. Actually, it's noontime.
Oh, it's noon.
Isn't it?
It's right. Both of us are really okay. On the ball here.
Okay. We speak to him every Tuesday at noon.
Exactly.
When we come back, we're going to pick up where we left off yesterday, talking about the Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman's case and Zimmerman's acquittal. Dan Henry is the father of D.J. Henry. He's going to join us. We're going to look at this trial and the verdict from Mr. Henry's point of view. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Take a room full of art collectors, a one-of-a-kind piece of art, and begin.
Last chance tonight, $43.5 million. Fair warning, selling it this side, not yours. All done at $43.5 million. For you, sir, $43.5 million.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, buyers, sellers, and the gavel, the CEO of Christie's, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, offering 7 evenings at Symphony Hall with a lineup of speakers that includes a prime minister, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a humorist, and even a former spy. BostonSpeakerSeries.org. And the Northbridge Companies, who believe assisted living shouldn't be a place where time passes, but rather a place where time comes alive. If you agree seniors deserve to live well and love life, you can find their local communities at NextGenerationSeniors.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A family in Easton, Massachusetts understands better than most what Trayvon Martin's parents felt last February, then on this past Saturday night. Dan and Angela Henry's son, DJ, was killed by a police officer in Pleasantville, New York, following a football game he played for Pace. Like Trayvon, DJ was unarmed. Unlike Trayvon, the DA refused to even indict in DJ's case. Shortly thereafter, the policeman who fired the fatal shot was named Officer of the Year in Pleasantville by the local Patrolman's Benevolent Association. DJ's parents fight on a number of fronts, which we'll describe in a couple of minutes. But first, joining us is DJ's father, Dan Henry. Dan, good to talk to you.
Good to speak with you as well, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi, Dan. What did you think about the acquittal of George Zimmerman, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's painful for lots of us for lots of reasons. I will tell you that the pain I feel is less related to the acquittal. It's much more related to the sense that I have, and that many who lost loved ones have, of just how painful and tragic the loss of any life is. And so Angela and I really are much more sympathetic to the fact that this family has lost a young child, and whether that's to an accident or to war or to a horrible crime, we know that pain.
I'm sorry.
We empathize with that.
Speaking of that, you talked about you and your wife, Angela, have been crusaders on lots of wonderful things in DJ's name, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. How about your kids, Kyle and Amber? That's correct, right? That's their names?
That's so, right. That's
how
right.
did Kyle in particular, but both of them, react to the verdict, Dan Henry?
Well, I think for them, it leaves them to ponder how our system rights itself when a wrong is done. And they live this more through the experience they've had with their brother, who we know now with hard evidence and great certainty was the clear victim that night. The evidence supports that. The testimonies that have come out support that. And what we've uncovered about what was attempted there to cover up the actions of Aaron Hess support that. So I think my kids are looking at that saying, well, when will the Department of Justice weigh in? It's clear that he intended to do DJ harm. And is this another, miscarriage of justice as it relates to what happened in the Martin case? Now, again, I'm not casting any judgment about what the ultimate judgment should have been or the effectiveness of the prosecution or defense. But the point is that it just seems that these matters sometimes get prosecuted in a way that doesn't actually comport with what the evidence says.
I want to stay on your son, Kyle, just for a second. Reverend Eugene Rivers is with us every Monday, and we were talking about this yesterday. Here's what Gene Rivers said about the advice that he gives his son, Malcolm.
My son is 26 years old, 6'2", black dude, martial artist. I said, Malcolm, let me tell you something, dude. It ain't fair, but you get in an environment like that, run. In fact, fighting does. See, and my son does two martial arts, Krav Maga and Jiu-Jitsu. And he likes to fight. I said, dude, I called him up. I said, listen, son, I don't hear nothing about no Krav Maga. Run. White boy runs up on you. Run.
So did you ever give similar sort of special advice to DJ, or have you given that kind of advice or any kind of special advice to your son, Kyle Dan Henry?
I mean, I've tried to sensitize my sons to the reality of the environment we live in, right? And so they see me living in the same environment with the same skin color. But matters of race in our family aren't, they're not paramount. What we talk about is humanity. And so there's a certain value system that we've instilled in our children. That's to respect their elders, respect authority, to do the things that that put them in the right situation. And when you think about what happened with DJ, he was doing all of those things, complying right up to the moment of his death. And so for Kyle, the lesson there is really more, you know, he did all the right things. He did all the things you taught us to do, irrespective of the color of his skin, because he's a good human being. And we have to hope that that gets recognized in how the Department of Justice weighs in here. Race in this country has been a part of our dialogue from the very beginning, but in the case of my family, we try not to make that the only thing we talk about, because at the end of the day, these are human issues as much as they are issues of color.
We're talking with Dan Henry. Dan and Andrew Henry lost their son, DJ, who had been a football player at Pace University. He was shot by a police officer there, and nothing has happened. We're going to talk about what may happen soon, we hope. But one thing I wanted to ask you, Dan, is I had a chance yesterday to talk to some teenagers, young teenagers in Dorchester. And, you know, there's a lot of shootings that go on in the city of Boston. A lot of these kids are very aware and careful and, you know, don't want to get caught on the wrong corner at the wrong time or get in the middle of any gang disputes. But they were sort of stunned by the idea. What they took out of this Trayvon Martin case was that, as one of them said, I better not wear a hoodie in a white neighborhood. They knew about the dangers where they were. They had sort of an idealized view of if they get out of there and were in a Wellesley or a Brookline or a mixed-race town, and you live in a mixed-race town, that it would be better, and they were a little discouraged by this. What do you think about that reaction?
Yeah, I think it's their reaction, so I won't question it. I'm sure it's earnest if that's how they felt. What I would encourage them to do, though, is think beyond that and to recognize that that excellence comes in all colors, and that just living in a way that actually is a direct contradiction to the stereotype is actually the better path, in my view. And that's the message I've sent to my own family, and that's how I've tried to live my life as an example. That you know, living the right life is a better path, frankly. And there aren't places they shouldn't be able to go with a hoodie. But if they're conditioned to believe that, then that's unfortunate to me, because it puts limits on a person who, you know, frankly, shouldn't have any limits. And those are silly limits that sometimes I think we buy into. And, you know, it's unfortunate that that would be the case for these kids.
Dan Henry, you know, obviously the national talk is whether or not the Department of Justice under Eric Holder will do something in the Trayvon Martin case. I'm sure you know that the Attorney General is actually totally by coincidence speaking in Orlando, right down the road from Sanford, to the NAACP, which is calling for action. You've asked for similar action. It's been a long time. I mean, it's October 2010. Where is this? Where are you with the Department of Justice?
Yeah, well, they are still reviewing this, and frankly, we think it's taken too long. We think the evidence is absolutely crystal clear. The civil depositions are continuing. They're almost actually complete, and it's been made clear in those depositions that this guy, this charter son, acted unlawfully, that the police officer who shot him, attempting to protect our son rather than being celebrated, he should have been named Officer of the Year. He was told to go get an attorney. That our son nearly stopped his car, and that Aaron Hess, by his own admission, jumped on the hood of the car and shot DJ through the windshield, that DJ was only reacting to Aaron Hess's reckless intent, and that he pulled his gun when DJ's car was still sitting stationary in front of the tavern. So he clearly intended to do him harm. And the standard the DOJ needs to be able to demonstrate is intent. And we think intent is absolutely crystal clear here. And it goes even deeper than that. I mean, there are lots of admissions here that the original story that was shared with the public was fabricated. That the very chief who prosecuted this said the DA's office was involved with him that morning, the morning of our son's death, creating this fabricated account that was issued to the public to intentionally mislead the public. That his lieutenant, active lieutenant there, actually altered the statements of the officer that shot at the officer who shot DJ to make it appear as if he was feeling threatened. He said, that's not the case. I was shooting at the guy in the car who was the clear threat to the kid in the car. And we think intent can be demonstrated. Now, whether or not they act, that remains to be seen. We hope they will. We're still confident that if you just look at the evidence, and not why he did what he did, but what he did, that what he did is unlawful. And if you take a human life unlawfully, by definition, that is murder. And we think he should face those charges.
So how does it actually happen, Dan Henry? Who decides whether your case goes forward or not?
This is pending now with the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, but we are efforting an audience in Washington to make certain that everything that needs to be done locally is done locally. So it will either be the U.S. Attorney in New York, or it will be somebody in D.C. ultimately.
And if I remember correctly, Dan Henry, I know you correct me if I don't, both senators at the time, John Kerry obviously has moved on and Scott Brown has moved on involuntarily, both were attempting to help get the Justice Department to move. So what is the holdup? I mean, by the way, I independently have looked at all the facts that Dan Henry just recited, and I find them to be exactly as he says them to be. What's the holdup? This theoretically should not be an unsympathetic Justice Department. Why is this taking so long, and why do you don't even know if they're ultimately going to do anything at all?
That's right, Jim. And I think the view Angela and I have about this is that perhaps what they're doing is waiting for civil depositions to be completed so that they have on evidence and in the case record the testimony of those who are most closely associated with this, both what happened to DJ and the subsequent attempt to cover it up. They now have most of that. And when you compare that to the physical evidence, it's absolutely crystal clear. It's crystal clear that this was wrong and that there were attempts to cover it up. So my only hope is that the indictments will even go beyond Darren Hess. And that they're waiting to be able to make sure that they've got enough evidence to issue broad indictments against those who attempt to cover this up as well.
You know, Dan, you and Angela and your kids and your friends and supporters have decided not to, while you pursue justice for your kid, you've also created this thing called the DJ Dream Fund. I know you've helped close to, in fact, more than 1,000 kids in the last couple of years. Give us the short version. What are you doing with this fund? How can people help and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's really carrying on DJ's spirit of giving. And the idea is that too many children face no's in their childhood simply because they don't have the finances to participate in the things that create the best childhood memories, sports, fitness, activities, lessons, swimming, et cetera. And we want to give that yes to children by removing the financial burden that stands in the way of them being able to be involved. And so the DJ Dream Fund provides the scholarship support to allow kids to say yes to things that kids want to do, play Pop Warner, rec basketball, therapeutic riding, swimming lessons, piano lessons, art lessons. As you say, in the first 2 years, we've helped well over 1,000 kids throughout New England, New York, and now into North Carolina. And we're really, really proud that DJ's name lives on through the experiences of every one of these kids. Almost by default, they become DJ's kids. And so while we're waiting, we're serving.
And it's djdreamfund.org is the website, correct, Dan?
That's correct.
Dan, one last question. Aaron Hess was the police officer who shot your son, DJ, when he was a student playing football down at Pace University in Pleasantville, which is the name of which always kind of kills me, Pleasantville, New York. What is the police officer, Aaron Hess, now doing? What's his status?
He has left force. You know, frankly, based on what we know and evidence, should not have been hired to the force.
Okay.
Was not fit for duty and is not being returned to duty.
Left the force because of this or on his own accord?
We think because of this.
Okay.
But again, there were efforts here to cover that track a bit, but clearly it's related to this.
Dan, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. We very
Dan,
much appreciate it.
Best to Angela and your
thank
kids.
You.
That was Dan Henry. Dan and Angela Henry lost their son, DJ, and they are trying to get the Justice Department to really look into this case, and they should be looking into this case.
By the way, one of the finest families I've ever met in my
Wonderful.
Life. They are unbelievable. And the work
Wonderful.
They do. You know, we talk a lot,
family.
Whether it's Tina Cherry with the Louis D. Brown Peace mm-hmm. Institute, named after her teenage son, who was killed on his way to a Christmas time peace rally. Families who lose children to unthinkable acts like this, who decide, rather than trying to put it out of their mind as best as one can, because of course you never can, but try to do things in the name of their lost child, are saints. And I have to say, they are doing wonderful work, and we hope you'll support it.
We're going to open up the lines now to get your thoughts, calls, emails on the George Zimmerman verdict, what you think about it. The juror last night on the Anderson Cooper show said that she did not think race came into this at all. Do you think that's true? I wrote a piece this morning in the Boston Herald about young men in Dorchester who think the lesson of the Trayvon Martin killing is if you're a black kid, don't wear a hoodie in a white neighborhood. And if you go to a white neighborhood, be very careful. Everybody knows you're not there to do bad things. What's your take on the verdict, on what Dan Henry just had to say? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, or bpr@wgbh.org.
I'd also like to hear what your thoughts are on the potential racial divide here. Peniel Joseph from Tufts was here yesterday and said there is not going to be a racial divide, that there is a huge, there is a majority, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he said there's a majority of people of all colors and all backgrounds who are feel an injustice was done here. There was a piece, Greg Whalen is a great reporter at NECN, did a piece last night with mostly kids, but maybe some young 20s too, maybe 13 up to 23. Every single black kid whom he interviewed thought an injustice was, these are Boston people, every single black kid whom he interviewed, including one of the people in your piece, by the way, thought an injustice had been done, and every single white kid or young man who he interviewed thought that the jury got it right. So while it's only anecdotal, and all we have is anecdote because there's no polling done, yet my sense is that's what we're going to end up seeing again, is the vast majority of black Americans feel that a wrong was done in that courtroom down there in Florida, and the vast majority of whites seem to think that justice was done. 877-301-8970. What's your take on all this?
I'll also repeat the quote from the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, who said, "It's a chilling thought that you can be in a neighborhood out buying a soda and a pack of Skittles and have your life taken from you by someone who just thinks you don't look like you belong there." That's Deval Patrick, who, of course, has been a long time since he was growing up in the south side of Chicago. But that's his perspective, and that was the perspective of the kids in Dorchester.
Well, what about the story he's told us? And he wrote in his book about being a young Milton student and walking to a friend's house and a cop stopping him because he didn't fit into that neighborhood. I mean, Milton then and now is mostly a white suburban community, and there was this young black kid. I think he was walking to either a teacher's house or a friend's house, and he was stopped. I mean, it's just...
Well, that's one of the great ironies of this story, because there have been so many shootings in Boston since the mayor. I think the number's up to 85 now, and kids in neighborhoods that are affected by this in parts of Roxbury, parts of Dorchester, parts of Mattapan, they know that their own streets are dangerous. They know that they don't want to get caught in the gang fire, somebody shooting at them, you know, another black kid like themselves. But I think there was some sense that, gee, if you get out of there, it'd be different. You wouldn't have to worry about these things anymore. And now it's like, well, maybe you do, even if you're lucky enough to somehow wind up in the middle of Wellesley or the middle of Brookline, that it's going to be better for you there. And this makes them doubt that, at least some of the kids I talked to. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Danielle in Cambridge. What do you think, Danielle?
Hi, I'm just calling because I'm from Trinidad. I'm Afro-Caribbean. My husband is Hungarian, and, you know, we have a son that looks just the same color as Trayvon, and he is only 4, and he likes to wear hoodies, too, just because he speaks fluent Hungarian and English. I mean, he's clearly going to end up in these white neighborhoods, too, because he has friends of all colors. And it just saddens me that, you know, we live our lives really thinking almost colorless, really. We're really lucky in that way. But now I think when he gets a little taller, a little older, I'm going to have to tell him that if anyone accosts him of any color, he has to put his hands up, don't make any sudden moves, and always try to de-escalate the conflict, which is, you know, so hard for someone of Trayvon's age at 17 to know how to do. But this is the conversation we have to start having as parents who have mixed-colored boys, you know, and I guess it just saddens me. I feel like there's no amount of education. I'm a doctor. My husband's a professor. There's no amount of education that we can give our son that's going to protect him. Because as soon as they look at him, that's all they're going to see.
Danielle, does your husband feel the same way you do?
I think he is, again, he's just kind of stunned by the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And he kind of stands, it won't happen to, okay, I just don't think he can, I don't think he can bear the thought of something like that happening to our son. But, you know, I think he doesn't tell me I'm crazy. Like, he would, you know, he really would say more like, "Damn, what are you talking about?" I think he kind of slowly is letting it permeate. And, you know, his response was, "Well, there's no point. He doesn't have to go to Florida anyway." I'm like, but that's what spring break is, you know, that's what spring break is, you know? I mean, our son probably will end up going there if he stays here.
Hey, Danielle, thank you for a great call to start this off. Good luck with your son. 877-301-8970 is our phone number.
Cassie in the car. Thanks for calling, Cassie.
Oh, yes. Hi. I'm just calling because it's such an important case. I'm so glad you're giving it the attention that you are and that you're obviously concerned what time it is. I drove a school bus in Boston desegregation way back when, and there wasn't the same interest and, you know, and awareness. So anyway, and I just feel like the when the juror said that race was not involved, I find I live in Concord. I mean, to me, that's just sort of a, I don't know, a general assumption on white America. That's exactly what the issue is for African-Americans, is that people think that because it's not named, that nobody is reacting to it. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you. Yeah.
I couldn't hear you, actually.
But, you know, so I think that's part of the issue is that, you know, what I found is that when, you know, there's different cultural assumptions and the culture encourages young people to speak up and speak out, whereas in my own culture, you know, we're sort of taught to be polite and be quiet and be respectful and you know, to resolve without emotion. There's different expectations and the assumptions on what is a problem. You know, there's a lot of a lot of ignorance that costs race about different cultural, meanings.
Cassie, can I be clear? Were you surprised? Were you saying that when the juror said, with the Anderson Cooper interview, the juror said that race didn't enter into this at all? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that's typical of what I see in the whole country. The white
see.
Attitude towards race. I'd say more widespread. I don't want to be too global about this. But that's a general assumption in white culture is that if race isn't mentioned by name, then people are not acting about it.
Cassie, thank you for the call. I mean, in this case, the juror was essentially following the prosecutor's lead, who basically said race is not an issue. I found that hard to believe, that was the prosecutor's position. I mean, you can believe, I think Alan Dershowitz maybe even said this yesterday. I believe he said, he said it was a slam dunk for acquittal, at least his analysis of the law and the facts in this case. That didn't preclude there from being racial profiling in this case. And it's pretty clear, I think, to most objective people, even if you agree with the verdict, that there was racial profiling by George Zimmerman, no?
I guess that's the thing. I mean, it was George Zimmerman that was on trial, and the jury was a jury of his peers, I guess, even though they were all women. But what's weird to me is that you can, with a case that, to me, so clearly involved race, it just didn't seem right that there was not a single African-American or even a biracial person that sat on that jury, because I think it's a walk a mile in my shoes kind of thing. I think it's very hard to understand these things when you have a completely different experience as a white person than you do as a black person or a person of color.
Let's go to David in Fairhaven. You're on with Jim and Marjorie, Boston Public Radio. Hey, David.
Hi, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. How are you guys?
Great, thanks.
I just had a couple of observations. One of them is that George Zimmerman was guaranteed by the Constitution to be the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. Why wasn't Trayvon Martin afforded that same protection that night?
You mean by Zimmerman?
Zimmerman is guaranteed.
No, you meant why wasn't Trayvon Martin given the presumption of innocence by George Zimmerman?
Exactly.
Well, I think, my conclusion, it's brilliantly put by you, David, is that he did racially profile him. I think the history with Zimmerman suggests that to be the case, but you can separate that from those who believe, who are, again, the Dershowitzes of the world, who believe despite that there was, the law was all, and facts were all on the side of George Zimmerman. David, thank you so much for the call. 877-301-8970. You know, we talked to John King a minute ago. I think the pressure is immense on Eric Holder to do something in this this situation. Again, I hate to keep quoting Dershowitz, but he knows this stuff. Dershowitz thinks there's a very thin reed, if any reed at all, for the Justice Department to hang its hat on here. But it seems to me that he's got to find that reed and do something, don't you think?
Yeah, but there's a lot of these legal analysts that are all over the news and the papers this morning saying it would be really, really hard, and you'd have to prove that it was all about race for Zimmerman, that he, the reason he went after Trayvon Martin in the first place, and that's a high standard. But on the other hand, sometimes I feel about these cases. I felt this about Cardinal Law in the child abuse case in the Catholic Church here in Boston. Even though many people, like Tom Riley, who was then the Attorney General, thought he could never win the case, I felt, indict him anyway. let's see how the case unfolds. And
well,
I feel
except
like,
you know, that's what Angela, whatever her name is, Corey, would say. That's what we did. She wouldn't admit that, but that's essentially what they did in Florida. They indicted, and the outcome was they got nothing.
Well, I think it was better that they indicted. Had they not indicted George Zimmerman at all, had they just said, we're not going to do anything about this, a 17-year-old kid is dead, we're going to do nothing.
But did they do it because they thought that there was a case on the merits, or did they do it because there was pressure? And the six-week delay between killing and indictment suggests to, I think, a lot of people, including me, that they didn't do it because they thought they had a case, even though I thought they had a case, but they did it because there was a huge public uproar to which they had to respond.
They did it because there was a huge public uproar, but I think there would be much more of a public uproar had they done nothing.
I agree with you.
Let's go to Sarah in Newton. What do you think, Sarah?
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
I was just two things. I think that the first tragic thing is that it wasn't investigated, and his story makes zero sense. If he couldn't, you know, slap him or get him off of him, how could he reach for his gun? I don't get that whole thing. But the second thing is the whole hoodie thing. Have you, Marjorie, you probably shop for your kids. I cannot find a sweatshirt without a
hoodie.
On
I know. Everybody wears them.
And you know what came out after that? It was like, okay, we didn't do our job for 40 days. Oh, but he had a hoodie on. So I'm like, it's not a ski mask, not, you know, something untoward.
Sarah, is your point?
Like every other teenager.
Yeah, but there's a difference. I mean, actually, Liz Walker, the former Channel 4 anchor and now the Reverend Liz Walker, was on my television show last night, and she had something in her lap, and I thought it was her jacket because it was cool in the studio. And in the middle of the interview, she pulled her so-called jacket out, and it turns out it was a hooded sweatshirt that she put on to make the same point that, I guess, to a degree you're disputing. But I think her point, at least the point we discussed last night, is it's not just the hoodie. It's the color of the kid in the hoodie that makes a difference. I mean, you're right. Everybody wears hoodies.
I agree with her.
Okay.
I agree 100%. Okay. What I'm saying is when they came out after they botched this whole thing, after they let the guy go, didn't investigate at all of a sudden, all over television, it's becoming like the hoodie, like he was a robber or something.
Oh, you mean it's being used to disparage Trayvon Martin? I misunderstood
you.
I'm sorry. Okay.
100%. And I have a ton of teenage nieces and nephews, male and female. I personally, I cannot find a sweatshirt without.
Yeah, they all wear them. No, you're absolutely right. They all wear them. But I think that's
like
these kids in Dorchester were saying to them was a lesson of this case. If I'm going to go be hanging around in Wellesley, I better not wear a hoodie because
then every other kid in Wellesley is wearing a hoodie.
Right,
you can't find a sweatshirt without it.
That's right. But their argument is that if you're a black kid wearing a hoodie, you're in a much more dire danger than if you're a white kid wearing a hoodie.
There are going to be a lot of hoodies cut off sweatshirts in the near future, Sarah, I guess, is the moral of the story.
I honestly think that they literally came out with that because they were invoking race from the very start because they didn't investigate it.
You mean those who really, as I think it was Pinil who said it yesterday, Gene Rivers said yesterday that essentially it was Gene, that Trayvon was on trial, not just George Zimmerman. Sarah, thank you for the call. I'm sorry. Hello?
Oh, no.
You had one more thought? Go ahead.
No, I'm all set. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We're all set, too. Thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. We're talking about the aftermath of the Zimmerman acquittal. Will there be a racial divide? Marjorie wrote a piece about it on the front page of the Boston Herald today. Greg Whalen did a spectacular piece, I thought, last night on NECN, interviewing a lot of young black kids, a lot of young white kids, and it was a clean sweep. Every white kid thought the right outcome happened down there in Florida, and every black kid thought there was an injustice.
Let us go to Dan in Winchester. What do you think, Dan?
Hey, how you guys doing today?
Good.
Thank you for the call.
Thanks for taking my call. I think there was definitely some racism involved, but I don't think it was on the part of the jury. I think it was on the part of the media. I think you guys have been stirring this pot from the very beginning, and I think that I agree with Alan Dershowitz. This was a slam dunk. This never should have been brought to trial. If this was white on white or black on black or Hispanic on Hispanic crime, No one would have ever heard of this.
I think that's true, but Dan, you don't agree with all the respect with Dershowitz. While Dershowitz and you agree that there was no case on the merits and that acquittal was the only right outcome, I believe he went out of his way to say yesterday there was racial profiling. That's without a doubt, but that's not relevant, according to him, to the ultimate determination. Now, as to the media thing, where this started off on a horrible foot is the case that now actually is leading to litigation. Mark O'Mara is representing Zimmerman against NBC News because right. You remember at the beginning of this thing when this young producer doctored the 911 tape to make it sound as if Zimmerman was offering that Trayvon Martin was black when in fact he was responding to a question which said, right. Is he black, is he whatever? From that point forward, it was pretty hard for the media to recover. But I don't think it's a mutually exclusive notion, Dan, for you to believe there's racial profiling and he deserved to be acquitted.
But wait, before you go, Dan, so you don't think that there's an investigation, a pretty extensive investigation warranted when someone is an unarmed person is shot dead going back to their father's house?
I do. I do believe that investigation is warranted. But I think once the review is made and there's a determination not to proceed, well, that happens every single day. Do you honestly believe that if you know this were black on black crime, that it would even be
we never would have heard of the case.
But it would have been investigated, Dan. When I don't know about you, Dan, but most of the time, in my experience, if someone's murdered, there's a big time investigation. It's murder or it's death.
You mean by the DA?
Yeah. I don't think
you
should be calling it murder. I mean, the fact is,
Someone's dead. Someone's dead. A killing. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Dan, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. We're going to try to squeeze a few more.
I think what you don't investigate, there's a lot of the classic thing that they never try, and it drives me crazy, are rape cases. They almost never make it to trial, and that's partly because victims don't come forward, but it's partly because they are so difficult to prove, because in those cases, just like in the Trayvon Martin case, it's the victim who gets on trial. But murders and killings and deaths are almost always investigated, in my experience. Anyway, let's go to...
No, I think, but in defense of Dan, I think Dan's point was not about an investigation, unless I'm wrong. His point was the media hysteria, for lack of a better expression, over this was a function of the race of the shooter and the race of Trayvon Martin. Had George Zimmerman been black and Trayvon Martin obviously been black, we never would have heard about this case, and that's true.
I think we heard about this case because there was no arrest or investigation.
Yeah, but
if there had
been no arrest where a black George Zimmerman had shot black Trayvon Martin, we'd never have heard of the case because, as Gene Rivers says, that happens every single day.
But the reason there was the brouhaha is because the sense was that the authorities down there took the word of this armed watchman and said, okay, that's fine. Go your way, Mr. Zimmerman.
Right, who happened not to be black. I think that was a huge part of that. I think on that note, Dan is right. Let's go to Quincy. Lisa's on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Lisa, thanks for the call.
Hello.
Hi.
My point is, I think the racism all lies on the Sanford Police Department for just taking George Zimmerman's word for it and not speaking on behalf of Trayvon Martin and not trying to see it from his perspective.
Yeah, well, listen, I do too. I think I think the problem here is that there was somebody 17 years old who was black who was killed by a white guy, and that let's face it, bring up the issue of possible racism. I think, again, if it had been a dead white kid and it had been a black guy that shot him and there was no investigation for all those days, there would have been an uproar about that too.
And there'd probably be jail time. Lisa, thank you for the call. Let's go to Salem where Jacoby is on the phone. Jacoby, you're on with Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for the call.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I guess I just wanted to point out the fact that in my life as an African-American that the racial disparity in our society, this case doesn't really resonate with me on that level. Not that I think that it was that he shouldn't have been acquitted, but every day I live my life, I run into some kind of circumstance in which racial disparity plays out. I guess perhaps the point that I wanted to make is, given that I'm currently in an interracial relationship and my partner and I are going to adopt, it's really hard for me to conceptualize adopting a minority child because I don't want them to have the same experience which I have had growing up. And I've been in multiple types of situations in which, you know, most of my education has been actually in predominantly white schools in the Baltimore City public school system. So I think it's a very unfortunate situation that it played out like this.
I think also that if it was the other way around, like you guys are saying, black on black crime, or a black person actually shot a white person, that this situation probably wouldn't have played out the way it played out.
You know, Jacoby, am I pronouncing your name right, Jacoby?
Yes.
Okay. You mentioned that, that there's been a lot of racial situations that you've encountered. Like what? People thinking you were doing something that you weren't, that kind of stuff?
Yeah. I walk in a store and I get followed all the time, you know.
Yeah.
Just because I'm a very dark-skinned person. And it's not to say that the experience of people that are probably lighter colored than me don't face that situation. But, you know, I can't even walk into a store, even though I'm middle class and not struggling middle class, but you know, I still get followed around as if, and I'm not wearing a hoodie, you know. I'm in business clothes often. I'm an educator. So it's quite unfortunate. Even coming into Massachusetts in 2000 to attend school at Northeastern, my first week on campus, I was attacked by a Caucasian bum because I went to use the ATM. And so I left Baltimore to come to Massachusetts for a better life, thinking that, you know, racial disparity would be less prevalent, but it still exists. It's more covert, with the exception of walking in the store and blatantly being followed. But it definitely still exists. And because of that, I do not want to adopt minority kids. I'd rather have Caucasian kids, because how am I going to explain to them that they can't walk in the store? You know, it's very difficult, like one of the previous callers said, to tell your child, run, or to put your hands up. Don't move. And, you know, instead of presuming that they're innocent until proven guilty, we have to operate and manifest the fact that we're guilty until we're proven innocent. It's just by default. That's what it is.
Hey, Jacoby, one last thing. When you're following around a store because people think you're shoplifting, how do you handle that? What do you do?
Well, sometimes depending on the situation, if it's something that I really need, such as groceries or something house-related, then, you know, I have no choice to buy it. But there have been times I've picked a whole bunch of stuff off the rack and just left it at the door. Can walk out, you know, and let them put it back. I mean, I can keep somebody employed. That's how I feel about it.
That was a great and horrible call all at once. Thank you so
very
much
for the call. Let's go to...
Is that horrible? In 2013, she is at the point she wants to adopt a kid. She's in a biracial couple. The likelihood is she will not adopt a kid of color, for fear that he or she will experience what she's had to experience.
Well, I put this in the paper, so I'm not telling tales out of school. Callie Crossy, one of our colleagues here, black woman who is impeccably dressed. She's always got the correct – is it brooch or brooch? I always mispronounce that.
We know what you mean.
The thing.
I'm not sure
the brooch,
it is.
The brooch, whatever it is. I mean, she's impeccably dressed, beautifully dressed. She told me in a story I was doing about this sort of thing that she was stopped in a drive-thru, I think it was a McDonald's, and questioned by police because someone had just escaped from Framingham State Prison. Now, Callie Crossley, who is, you know, Seven Sisters school graduate, gorgeously dressed, you know, I mean, looks as much like a prisoner as, you know, Kate Middleton looks like a prisoner. But she was stopped by the cops because she's black. You know, and so I think when you talk to people, I mean, judges, everybody's got stories like that. You know, driving while black, right? That's the thing, you get pulled over because you're driving while black. Happened to a big honcho at the Boston Globe. He was pulled over for driving while black.
Now the editor of a paper in the West?
Yeah. So
who are we talking about? Is that Greg Morris?
Moore. Yeah, it happens all the time. Driving while black on Christmas Day.
In any
pulled
case,
over.
Needless to say, we're going to stay on different angles of this whole Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman thing in the days ahead. And as you know, this afternoon, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, is speaking to the NAACP, which wants him to pursue this thing just down the road from where Trayvon Martin was killed. He's speaking in Orlando.
But up next, we are going to talk to Republican GOP guy Charlie Baker, who was the candidate for governor of Massachusetts. Maybe one of these days he's actually going to tell us if he's going to be again the candidate for governor of Massachusetts. We're going to talk to him about the people who have declared, the Democrats who have, and also we'll get his take on the Trayvon Martin case. That's next on WGBH Boston Public Radio.
A A summer stroll down Newbury Street is the perfect preview for the Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, presented by Citizens Bank. Nearly a dozen galleries will feature hors d'oeuvres and cocktails on Wednesday night, July 24th. Stroll, nibble, and sip while you browse artwork that'll be up for viewing and bidding throughout the Summer Arts Weekend. Check out all the events happening in Boston's Copley Square, July 26th, 27th, and 28th at bostonsummerarts.com.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Swords Point Productions, presenting Ron Maxwell's new movie, Copperhead, based on the novel by Harold Frederick. Copperhead stars Billy Campbell, Angus McFadden, and Peter Fonda, in theaters and on VOD Friday. And the Boston Landmarks Orchestra Summer Concert Series, bringing free music to the DCR's Hatch Shell every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. This week featuring Rhapsody in Green, landmarksorchestra.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here's State Treasurer, Steve Grossman, and then State Senator Dan Wolf, both Democrats, this past Saturday in Lowell, announcing for governor.
As the next governor of this Commonwealth, I pledge to you that I will make paid family leave the very first bill I file.
I'm Dan Wolf, and I'm proud to be standing before this convention as a candidate for the Democratic Party's nomination to be the next governor of Massachusetts.
Now, that was those two Democrats in Lowell. There are a couple of other Democrats who have announced as well. Now, here's Republican Charlie Baker. I think it was this past weekend that he said this. I don't have the exact date. Here he is.
My fellow Republicans, my name is Charlie Baker, and I'm running to serve you as the next governor of the great state of Massachusetts.
And here he is, I think fresh off that announcement. I'm not quite sure. Joining us as he does every Tuesday on Open Mic, Charlie Baker. Congratulations, Charlie.
You know, that newfangled internet, it's just amazing what you can do with that.
Okay, so that was 2010. We were off by a couple of years.
Charlie, when are you going to make up your mind here? Every week we ask you, and every week you're discussing it with your lovely wife, and there's the pros and the cons. But, I mean, come on, Charlie. We got to make a decision here, I think.
You know, it's funny how big a hurry you guys are. Are you just bored? Is that the problem? There's nothing
right
for you to talk about?
Nothing for us to talk about. It's hot.
It is hot, yeah.
Okay, but in all seriousness, so we have this Joe Avalone guy who I think is from Belmont. We have Donald Berwick.
I think he's actually from Wellesley.
Oh, my apologies, Wellesley. We have Donald Berwick, who was the head of Medicaid and Medicare for a while for the president, for Obama. There, who I assume you know probably pretty well. There's Steve Grossman. There's Dan Wolf. There are more to declare. Capuano's considering it. Martha Koch. He's the congressman from, obviously, from Somerville. There's Martha Koch. This, in all seriousness, Charlie,
About Mo Cowan. People talk about him, too.
Well, no, he's not doing it. He's not doing it. Are you serious about that?
Are you sure?
Yes,
Jim has the inside scoop on this,
Charlie. Well, he interviewed him. He said he wasn't doing it. But, of course, Martha Coakley said she wasn't doing it either.
Martha Coakley said she wasn't doing it either.
That's true. But in all seriousness,
good point.
Not as a potential candidate, but as a faithful Republican, do you not worry that if the Republicans continue to sit on the sidelines, and either you or Scott Brown or maybe even Bill Weld, I can't imagine him doing this job again, but your former boss, just sit on the sidelines.
He'd be better than all of the ones who've
declared
so far.
Are you not worried that the sand has gone through the hourglass here? It's time for somebody to move, no?
Didn't we have this conversation?
We're having it again because the Democrats are declaring.
What I'm actually remembering, Jim, was the conversation where you bemoaned the length of political campaigns and did they last forever? And, you know, by the time they're over, we wish they were done 6 months before. And
okay. Let me try it another way.
Did you say that, Jim?
Let me try it another way. What's the name of the woman who's chair of the Republican Party? Is it Kirsten Hughes?
Kirsten Hughes.
Okay. If you're Kirsten Hughes for a moment, are you not getting anxious that all these Democrats are getting play, a lot of high-profile announcements, and every Republican is still sitting on the sideline? Let's put it this way. What's the status of internal discussions? You told us you'd spoken to Scott Brown several weeks ago. What's the intra-Republican Party discussion going on about who's going to emerge on the Republican side?
Well, I guess what I would say is, first of all, those are, in fact, like private conversations, but they are happening, and people are talking about it. And everybody's well aware of the fact that there's a campaign in 2014 and that people need to get started at some point in 2013 to prepare for that. But, I tend to be one of these people who thinks that just because other people are in the pool doesn't mean everybody has to be. And there's plenty of time between now and 2014 for people to launch campaigns and do what they need to do to be successful.
Okay,
period.
So, Charlie, your idea on casinos when you were running last time, you were the one casino guy, were you not?
I was the one casino guy.
I have to say, I embraced that. I thought it was the best idea of anybody. So obviously you're a betting man. Since you're a betting man, what would you say on July?
That was a heck of a segue.
Thank you. On July,
wow,
whatever this
what
is,
pivot.
What would you say the odds are on, I'm serious on this, on you deciding to give this a go for 2014?
I've said to you before that, you know, this is a conversation Lauren and I have been having for quite a while, and I said, I think on your show a few months ago, that I would make a decision on this by the fall, and that's my plan, and I'm sticking to it.
No, but that wasn't answering my question. My question was,
you want to do 60-40, 70-30?
No, really, what are the chances of you 50-50. Deciding to do this again?
I gave him 50-50 on his show.
What is
when
it,
he and I talked about
what is it now? That was a month ago.
No, it's still 50-50.
Okay, I give up.
Now, you told me, Jim Brady told me something.
But I'm not done with this.
Before you're not done?
No, one more thing.
Oh, God.
Have you, other than you and Scott Brown, and Scott said, I think he said to the Globe or said to some, oh, the Globe covered, he didn't say to the Globe, he was in some speech, said he's thinking about it and who knows. Are there other Republicans who you think would be decent gubernatorial candidates? And don't just give me a list of names, but who you think, if either you or Scott decide not to do this, is there a second tier that you can imagine making a serious go here?
He's going to put someone in the second tier.
Let's face it.
Go
you're
ahead,
the two
put somebody
top
in the
tier
second
people.
Tier, Charlie.
There you go. That'll go over well with all my friends in the party. Yeah.
Okay, forget that.
What I guess I would say is that everybody said there'd be nobody to run for the Senate when Scott didn't run. And we ended up with three candidates who all got the signatures, all of whom I thought brought different skill sets and possibilities to the race. And it was a reasonably... I think competitive primary. Gabriel Gomez kind of came out of nowhere and won that, and I thought the big issue for him is one that a lot of Republicans face, which is you run once and you don't win because it's a hard state to win as a Republican, and then maybe you don't do it again, and that's so you don't benefit from what you learned from the first time. I think one of the things that I was kind of pleased about is that Gabriel seems to be thinking about. Continuing to pursue political
Yeah, but with all due respect, Charlie, you know that virtually every Republican, even if they were supporting one of the three men, were Winslow, who was here a week or so ago, and Michael Sullivan, the former U.S. attorney, former state rep, and Gabriel Gomez, almost all the Republicans were wringing their hands because you know, whether you'll admit it or not, people said, is Charlie Baker going to do this? Is Scott Brown going to run again? Is Bill Weld going to decide to run for the United States Senate. So, and I don't mean this to disparage any of the three men, but the reality is they were the second choices.
Let me ask you a question, Jim.
Yeah.
If at that Democratic convention, Deval Patrick had stood up and said, I'm running for a third term, what do you think people's reaction to that would have been?
I think
relative
there
to the people who are running.
I think there would have been unanimous something to endorse him on the spot.
Okay, so in some respects, we're already talking about a situation where on both sides of the aisle, you can always find people that folks would prefer over whoever it is that decides to actually step into the ring.
Can we move on from this?
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay, it's because I want to talk about Deval Patrick's political future. Jim told me right before the show that John Walsh, the legendary, I know I missed it, the legendary Democrat, the big get-out-the-vote guy, you know who John Walsh is.
What's chair of the party. Chair of the party.
Is chair of the party. Okay, he's leaving that job. You know what he's going to do, Charlie?
He's going to run the governor's PAC.
Yeah, what do you make of that?
I'm going to try not to make much of it because people constantly try to make something out of everything I say. But I do think it's interesting, and it certainly would sort of lead people to believe that they're thinking about the future.
Exactly, like Deval for president.
Since we established a few minutes ago that you're a betting man, Charlie Baker, what would you say the odds are that Deval Patrick would run for president in 2016?
I have absolutely no idea,
yes,
Jim. And I think speculation on that at this point in time is really speculation.
Well, I speculate.
There's
he'll run in 2016, he'll lose, and then he'll run again in four years.
Well, there's some speculation he'll run with Hillary Clinton, too. Hey, Charlie Baker, one of the things we know about you, and I think people who are close to you know that you are a really caring father, and I mean that sincerely. I've never heard anybody who knows you who doesn't say how much you love your kids. As a father, not as a Paul, not as a whatever, what was your reaction Saturday night when you heard the verdict in the Zimmerman case?
Well, my reaction has been the same as since the beginning, as a father and as a person, which is, you know, everybody involved in this has had their lives shattered. Trayvon Martin ended up lying dead on the street there. His family will never get over that. I frankly don't think the Zimmerman family or George Zimmerman are ever going to get over this either. This is just a classic tragedy all the way around, no matter, you know, whose so-called side you're on or how you look at it. And I find no joy for anybody in any of this.
But to me, there's one of the issues. I mean, we talked about the race stuff ad nauseum, but there's also the gun issue here. The idea that you are doing your neighborhood watch, which many people do in their neighborhoods. You know, it's gone on for years. But this is a guy doing a neighborhood watch with a concealed weapon.
And, legally, and we should say. But
absolutely.
With a concealed weapon, nevertheless.
Legally. Yeah. As a matter of fact, one of the jurors that was on the case had a license to carry a concealed weapon. The license had lapsed, but she did have a license to carry a concealed weapon. It's more of a gun culture in Florida. But that was one of the issues to me, that why you would carry a weapon.
The gun issue was less. The issue that I – did you guys read the interview with or watch the CNN interview with juror number 37?
Yes.
Yes.
Last night. Yeah,
okay, the most interesting thing I thought about all of that was the commentary about the Stand Your Ground law. And if I were – if I were to pick a place to go from here, I would be talking to people about that, because the big message that came out of that that's about the most if you were to say to yourself, when you pass something like a Stand Your Ground law, what's the most difficult situation you could ever imagine trying to work through from a legal point of view? It would be something like what happened with Martin and Zimmerman. And I think that's, for me, the thing people really ought to do coming out of this is have a conversation about whether or not, in fact, that statute as it's currently constructed makes sense.
Hey, Charlie Baker, can we get back to not you running, but the whole Republican? No, I'm serious about the Republicans in the corner office. Deval Patrick is having a miserable go this week and last with his fellow Democrats, the Speaker of the House and the Senate President, over this transportation bill and its funding and that sort of thing. If a Democrat can't convince two Democrats that this is the direction, a chief executive, that this is the direction the state should go, how does a Republican in 2014 or in beyond convince what is likely to be a Democratic Speaker and a Democratic Senate President to do anything?
Ice cream sundae parties on Friday afternoon.
Well, your boss, by the way, your former boss used to invite reporters in for beer on Friday afternoon.
Yeah, they probably don't do a lot of that anymore, Jim.
Yeah, no. But, in all seriousness, Charles, I have to say, one of the most compelling things that Marge and I talked about this a lot, the most compelling argument Mitt Romney had in, 2002, was the Gang of Three notion. Do you not want some balance? Do you not want one Republican, at least, in a position of power to balance all the other Democrats in power? And by the way, I find that to be a really appealing notion, even though that may surprise you. Having said that, how do they govern? How does a Republican govern in a state that's got virtually every legislator being a Democrat?
Well, I was there when two of them did it, and I thought did it pretty successfully.
Well, and Salucci.
And while I talk about ice cream sundaes on Fridays as a joke, I will say this: I can't remember them ever going 3 weeks without having face to face conversations with the leadership of the legislature.
Which is what the governor did with the two leaders last week.
And did you guys ever read the book that Woodward wrote about the breakdown and the negotiation around the grand bargain between Boehner and Reid and Obama and all the rest? All right, well, the big message that comes through in that book over and over again is there just wasn't a heck of a lot of personal connection at any level between or among any of those players. And if you want people to do really difficult, politically difficult and sort of policy difficult things, there's got to be – you have to have a certain level of personal trust and commitment to get from here to there. And I always think about – Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan solving the Social Security debate back in 1984, 86, I can't remember which one. But that was definitely one of those times when the two heads of the opposing parties basically said, we're going to do this and we're going to expect people to stand up and support it. And I think they could do that and get away with it because they had a great relationship with each other. And I think some of that, frankly, has been lost in politics. And I'll tell you right now, in business, if you don't have those kinds of relationships with people, it's just as hard to get stuff done. People trust matters, and communication matters, and the ability to believe that somebody's going to be there to the bitter end matters when you have to do difficult things.
I couldn't agree with you more, by the way. The absence of respect is a huge, huge issue.
So, Charlie Baker, your boss, Bill Weld, famously dove into the Charles River when it was a lot less clean than it is now. Did you hear about this, that the first public swim has been okay in the Charles?
They did it last Saturday.
50 years.
No, I swam across the Charles River when I was in college.
You did not.
I did.
Oh, God.
Tell us about that, please.
It was late, and I was fortified. Let's put it that way.
Did you have to
give us the whole deal here?
Push flotsam and jetsam out of the way?
The whole thing was completely a dare, and and the one thing I'll tell you, because it's kind of funny, I as I wandered down in the dark in my bare feet and my street clothes to step into the river, I actually stepped on a dead animal, which almost froze me out of doing it at all. But I did it, and it was not a pleasant experience.
What kind
and
of
I
animal?
Took a very long, very hot soapy shower when I got back.
Was it like a muskrat? Or
I
was
have
it a
no idea what it was.
Alligator?
I did not look, and I ran.
I'm sure your family was really proud of you, Charlie.
Yeah.
So are you ready to go back again, Charlie, or what?
And jump in the Charles?
Yeah.
Oh, look, I think if you think about the Charles and you think about Boston Harbor and you think about some of the other stuff that's happened on the water side of things, the Quabbin as well.
Yep.
It's been a great 20 years in Massachusetts on that stuff.
Yeah, it's not
bubbling.
And
that was all done, by the way, with a fair amount of bipartisan cooperation.
Hey, Charlie Baker, thanks so much. Thanks for telling us about the swim, and we'll talk to you next Tuesday.
Okay, guys, take
next
care.
Tuesday, Charlie I'm sure Baker. He'll tell us whether or not he's running for governor.
I'm asking him every Tuesday. I don't care whether he tells us or not.
Charlie, thank you very much for being with us. As Jim said, Charlie is with us every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, Open Mic features Boston Globe editor Brian McGroy. The reason we've been asking Charlie Baker and CNN's John King about the Charles River is because, as Jim said, the first public swim of the Charles River in 50 years took place last Saturday. Former Governor Bill Weld famously dove into the Charles in 96. So we're going to ask you, would you swim the Charles River? It's now going to B grade from the EPA. Is that good enough for you? Swimming in the Charles, up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
For a decade now, there's been a massive effort to defeat malaria in Africa. The plan? Distribute millions of insecticide-treated bed nets that repel and kill mosquitoes. But in some areas, those nets are starting to fail. The insecticide in them, it's not killing mosquitoes like it used to. A resurgence of the deadly disease may be coming. Can it be avoided? Our story next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Blue Homes, building modern style and green homes. On July 19th and 20th, Blue Homes is hosting a Breeze House tour in Copaic, New York, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. More at bluhomes.com/tour. And Harvard Extension School, online certificate in strategic management. Registration begins July 29th. More information available at extension.harvard.edu. That's extension.harvard.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When it comes to the Charles River, maybe the slogan should be think or swim. Because if you thought about what's at the bottom of that river, would you really ever want to swim in it? We're going to ask you that in a minute at 877-301-8970. But first, joining us online is one man who has no qualms about swimming in the Charles. He was instrumental in organizing a public plunge into the river earlier this week, I think on Saturday. Franz Lawitz is with the Charles River Swimmers Club. Franz, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
So, Franz, did you get your tetanus shot before or after you jumped into the Charles River?
No,
I would have to go talk to my primary care doctor, actually, to make sure that I'm current, but I think I am.
Oh, good.
No, I've heard the rumors about back in the day when you fell and you had to go straight to MGH for a tetanus shot, but I don't think anybody does that these days.
So tell us, the Boston Globe reports it hadn't been since the 1950s. There had been a public swim. You organized it, got all the permits. Give us the quick version of how you got from a concept to actually jumping in on Saturday.
Well, the story actually goes back a little further than that. The primary function of the Charles River Swimming Club, which I'm a part of, is the organization is an annual swimming race, and that's been going on for about 8 years now. The community swim, which just took place this last Saturday, was a joint effort of the Charles River Conservancy and the swimming club. But I can say that the races were started with the intent of them sort of being a proof of concept to sort of turn the public's opinion a little bit from thinking of the river as being that dirty water to perhaps something that one day we might go swim in as we used to.
And by the way, but these were with more, as it's called, elite swimmers, correct?
Yes, it's okay. A mile race.
Yeah, okay.
And what happened? So, and tell us what happened on Saturday.
Well, on Saturday we had close to 150 quote-unquote regular people who came on down. We set up a sort of roped-off area in front of the dock, and everybody jumped in.
So tell us what that was like, because let me read you one line from the Globe story that described your day. It said, the bottom of the river remains a toxic mess, but if a swimmer can get in and out of the water without touching the squishy bottom, no tetanus shot is necessary. So what did it – some said it looked like beef broth. Other people said it looked orange. What was the experience, the experience
broth.
Like, Franz?
Well, I spent a lot of the time standing on the dock, and I can say that from the faces I saw, most people were actually pretty happy and pretty excited about being in the river. It is definitely true that it does not look anything like Cancun, but that's for good reason. It is a river. There's a great big watershed around it with leaves falling off trees and other sorts of things,
oh, it's beautiful.
And it tends to color the water.
Oh, so Franz, what's the future hold? I mean, obviously,
hold on. I just want to make sure you have to really tread water. I think that would be crucial if you're going to be jumping into the Charles, because you don't want to touch the toxic mass on the bottom with your toes, right? So you want to be sure your feet are you're treading water or at least
swimming
actively.
Yeah, and then one thing, of course, that does need to be made clear is that it's not a good idea it's also not legal for anybody to just go jump in the Charles at this time. The race and the community swim took place with special water quality testing that took place ahead of time.
Someone should have told Charlie Baker that 35 years ago. But okay,
right.
So Franz, yeah. What's next? For those people, and we know a lot in our newsroom who are saying, I'm dying to go do this. How does somebody do it? What's next for public swims in the Charles?
Well, I think, and of course, this swim only recently took place, but it went off very well. Everybody had a great time, and I think the plan is to look towards next year and at least have one more of these, hopefully more than one as well.
Great. Hey, Franz Lowitz, what's the website, by the way, for the Charles River Swim Club? Is there one?
There is. It's charlesriverswimmingclub.org.
Great.
Franz, just one last question. You may not know this, but perhaps you do. Is the bottom of the Charles always going to be a toxic mess, or is there hope that it will be less so if we keep taking care of it?
Yeah, that's actually a pretty complicated scientific question, one I'm not qualified to actually speak thoroughly to, but I can say that it is not insurmountable. There's plenty of other places around the world that have dealt with similar situations. And whether you do spot dredging or you build an artificial surface or you just use docks and have people go in and out off ladders, they're all viable options for working around the sediments.
I'll take Cancun. Hey, Franz Lowitz, thank you so much from the Charles River Swim Club. We appreciate your time. 877 and your efforts, 301-8970. So the question's simple. Would you swim in the Charles if you had the opportunity? Charlie Baker did it without a permit, apparently, when he was an undergraduate at Harvard. Franz Lowitz did it, I guess, part of this elite swimmers group in past years and part of this public swim. I didn't realize there were as many as 150 pupils he described. If you had the opportunity, if Franz called you on the phone and said, would you like to be part of our next group to jump into the Charles? And by the way, in this article says, part of the problem is not just the toxic mess as they describe it on the ground. It's hard to find a platform to jump into the river because there's so much broken glass and that sort of thing. So if you can find a spot where you can actually plant your feet.
Yeah, or
and
then wear you judge slippers.
You just have to be sure that you don't touch the bottom. So if you find that appealing, please give us a buzz. 877-301-8970. I have to say, even though you're going to mock me because you're going to say this is not possibly true, I find the notion of doing it once, which probably is the only amount you'll ever be able to do if you do it. No, I'm serious. I find the notion of jumping in once, if I was assured that I'd be safe, to be an actually really appealing thing to swim in the Charles. Well, how excited were you in was it 1996 that Weld dove into this thing?
Yes.
Weld and a state senator, I think his name was Bob Duran, who went on to be the environmental secretary.
Sewage out.
Right, they just dove in. He dove in with all his clothes. Nobody knew he was going to do it. It was such a great Weldian moment, by the way. It's so Bill Weld. It was great. Would you do it?
No.
Would you do it?
No. No, I would not do it. I don't like to think about toxic mess on the bottom. Even if I did have flippers on, they had to be special flippers, I guess, so that even my toes that were sticking out in the front of the flippers couldn't touch the bottom. And even though I'm pretty good at treading water, no. I've swum in South Boston. That was enough for me. Because
we're at Castle Island?
Yes, because you put your feet down. And even though on many days it's good, you can swim there, you do touch the bottom. You stand up and the bottom feels really
weird. Yeah, but
weird.
You're part of history. I mean, think how great it would be. To swim in the Charles. You're in the Charles.
I'll
watch
you, Jim.
You see the trees on both sides.
Jim,
you look at Starro Drive. You look at the memorial.
Dog paddle.
Well, by the way, that's fine. A doggy paddle will allow you not to touch, as you call it, the toxic mess on the base of the Charles River. I find it pretty appealing. Good for Franz Lowitz and all these other people in the Charles River Swim Club who did this thing. Again, it was the first time since the 1950s that there was a general public swim. That's pretty incredible.
Well, they do
the progress is amazing.
It is true. The view is going to be spectacular. You know, you're in the Charles. You can look in down and see Beacon Hill and all the buildings downtown. It looks pretty neat. It's like looking at, you know, at Boston from the Cambridge side of the water. But I think I just drive down Memorial Drive.
That's good enough for you. Okay, it's 877-301-8970. Would you do it? If so, why? If you wouldn't do it, tell us that too. Let's start in Roslindale with Mike. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Mike.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. Marjorie, you just asked a question about the toxic sludge on the bottom of the
Charles
River. Now, the only way, that's, of course, heavy metals and really dangerous, scary stuff that's settled in the bottom. The only way to get rid of it would be to dredge it, and that means using heavy equipment to dredge it. And that what that would do was it would bring it all up into solution. So it's a really catch-22 situation where you either leave it and you accept that the water quality is only going to reach a certain level and it's going to peak at that level because of the forever toxic sludge that rests in the bottom, or you dredge it and you create a really highly polluting situation during the dredging period and for some time thereafter. So that's why they basically, it's extremely expensive. I know they were doing it on the coast of New York and they were talking about it. There was a big article in the Globe several years ago I read. But so that's why it's not done. It's extremely expensive, and it just basically dredges up and puts all of that poison back into the water volume.
By the way, Mike, you sound like you know what you're talking about. So let me ask you this. Our producer did some research and found that between October, I think it was, of last year and March of this year, four bodies were found in the Charles. Does that contribute at all to the problem on the bottom, or is that a separate issue?
I would say that it would be a separate issue because you're talking about organic compounds, which are pretty natural. If those bodies degrade by bacteria and all, Jim, that wouldn't be a real problem. We're talking about heavy metals. We're talking about things that do not degrade.
I got it. That was a stupid question. Mike, thank you so much for the call. So, I mean, that is, we should have asked Franz this. That is an issue
degrading.
When you're having a public swim.
It sounds like so much fun.
There's a body that comes by. I mean, that's not a good thing.
Yeah, or it's like, you know, you talk to your parents or grandparents about the really polluted water when they used to have, like, you'd be swimming and you have to doing the breaststroke, you have to push the, you know, orange peels and other kinds of awful things out of your way as you made your way across the river.
But, you know, we should be fair. They really have. I mean, if you get to a B rating or whatever it is,
I remember
going
out as a young reporter and they took all the reporters out on a tour of Boston Harbor, and you're going along your boat, and you look out, and the water's like bubbling, like it's some kind of chemical experiment underneath you. So they have done huge, great
things.
Well,
that's the legacy of Paul
Levy.
I mean, prior to whatever.
Well,
I mean, he was at the Mass
Water
Resources
Authority.
He did an incredible job.
Yes, and they cleaned up Boston Harbor.
On budget and on time, by the way.
It was absolutely incredible, but still, I'm not sure I want to dive in there. Let us go to, is it Elia from
Elia,
Boston?
I think, yep. Hi, Elia. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Excellent.
Good.
What's
what do you
deal?
Think?
You know, I think ignorance is bliss because I go swimming in the Charles fairly often, and I didn't know it was that big of a deal. I do. I have a boat in Newton, which I take out just about every weekend in the summer and take a quick dip to cool down, except when there's the occasional algae bloom.
Now, where do you do this exactly, Elia?
Usually, right in the mouth of the river, between the Longfellow and the BU Bridge.
Wow. So you're right in the belly of the beast, as it were. Are you
worried
about the toxic sludge in the bottom?
I am now, I guess. I wasn't before.
Don't let it bother you. Now, I'm serious. Have you ever touched bottom? I mean, that is a serious issue. Have you ever touched bottom?
No, not really. It's about 12 feet where we usually are, and it's, you know, just a little surface swimming. I guess the only time that I've touched bottom is when I take the anchor out, and now I know I'm going to have to wear some gloves to, you know, when I remove the sludge off of the anchor.
Did you say a second ago I lost you for about 2 seconds? Why do you choose to swim in the Charles? Why do you do that?
It's actually a very nice place to anchor your boat.
So just jumping out of the boat thing. Okay.
Yeah. It's nothing special about the Charles per se, but it's nice to cool down on a hot summer day, take a little swim.
Elliot,
you
know, thanks
for
the great
question.
Call.
I don't know the answer to. Is it saltwater or
no.
combo?
I wouldn't even call it brackish. I'd call it freshwater. Most of the time, the river is flowing out towards the ocean rather than coming in.
Another guy who makes it sound terrific. Elliot, thanks for the call. Elliot, I'm serious. And Franz?
You can down at a community boating gym, get one of those little sailboats, sail out there in the middle of the harbor, because you are quite a sailor, as I know as well, and just dive off.
Well, actually, no.
And you can report back.
There's rarely a day that goes by that I'm not kayaking down or up or whatever, sideways
That's
on
right.
the Charles. Just jump out of the old kayak, hop your way back in.
Don't forget your big boy life jacket.
No, I actually can swim, despite your disparagement. I can swim. I cannot do the crawl. I can do everything else.
Don't paddle.
Okay, fine. Let's go to Roxbury.
Right.
Jim is on the phone with Jim and Marjorie. We're talking about the Charles River, the first public swim since the 1950s, happened last Saturday. Hey, Jim.
Hi. It was pretty scary back in the 50s. I used to go to the Fenway portion to try and fish. There was life at that time. You had, you know, fireflies. You had...
mosquitoes.
You had frogs, golden carp, and catfish.
Yeah.
However, you had all types of other things. Some things that are unmentionable floating around in there. It was quite pretty at that time.
Yeah.
And further down on the Charles, down beyond the Mass Avenue Bridge, we used to go to a boating club, and our greatest fear was falling in the water. We didn't worry about drowning. We worried about falling in the water.
That's
and,
a pretty great
I thought the governor was pretty brave when he pulled that publicity stunt. He showed up in old clothes and he dived in, but that was not a good move.
But that was so. For those who didn't live in Massachusetts for Weld,
head first.
It was such a great Weld moment. No one knew he was going to do it. I don't know if he knew he was going to do it. He just dove in. It was terrific. Jim, thank you.
So I saw it on the news. They had on old clothes, so I'm sure they were. Planning it.
Then the state senator who was responsible for whatever the bill was that they were celebrating, some environmental thing.
Afterwards.
He dove in after him too, and then that was 96, so it took 17
yeah,
years.
I remember it. I saw it on the news.
Yeah, I got it. Jim, thank you very much for the call. So let's wrap. What's the conclusion you reach, Marjorie, after this discussion? Franz is in there, and what conclusion do you draw?
The conclusion I draw is that I'm not going to the Charles River anytime soon. That would be my conclusion. I am absolutely not going to go.
Oh, actually, it turns out we have one last communique from the Charles. Our colleague, Edgar B. Herwick III, who is the man behind the Curiosity Desk, apparently is on the banks of the Charles. Edgar, where are you?
I am actually just now back into a van. I'm a passenger in a van just off the banks of the Charles River down near the Esplanade. In lovely Boston, Massachusetts.
And did you go in the water? I know that was your intention. We forgot about this. Did you actually get in the water?
Well, Jim, I can't say whether or not I went in the water, but I will tell you this. If I did go in the water, here are the things I would tell you about how the water is right now today. It is warmer than you would expect it to be. It is deeper than you would expect it to be, just off of a dock near the public boating area down by the Esplanade. And it is one of the most glorious experiences you are ever going to have on a 90-degree day on a Tuesday in the summertime.
If you're done,
I would tell you if I went into the water today.
And if you were to go into the water today, Edgar, did you bring your flippers to avoid that toxic mess on the bottom?
Well, my flippers, which are part of my hazmat suit that I would be wearing the entire time. I have a pair of sneakers that I use for just this kind of thing, Marjorie, which are, you know, a pair of light canvas sneakers, cheapos that you can kind of keep on if you're going to go into a pond or a river or something like that.
Yeah.
I would absolutely have kept them on if I went in today. I would have touched the bottom, and now I'm actually very scared having listened to you guys for the last few minutes about what I touched at the bottom of that river.
If you in fact touched anything. And by the way,
had gone in.
The reason Edgar is doing a retake take of O.J. Simpson's "If I Did It" in this case is because it's unlawful without
that's
a
right.
permit,
and he would not,
and no one at WGBH would ever break the law knowingly.
But if you were to try to,
if you had,
yeah, then the idea is that you'd have to kind of sneak over there incognito in a van and slip out, without anyone seeing you, and quickly jump in.
In theory, you would have to do that. But to be honest, I was down there talking with a lot of people. It's kind of busy down there. People on their lunch break, people down there painting, people hanging out at the community boating area, teenagers, folks of all ages. And, just talking to people who go there regularly, they say that they see people swimming from time to time in the Charles, both, before and after this weekend.
By the way, Edgar, in case you did it, or if you did it, there's a bathtub full of Purell ready for you to jump into when you get back to WGBH.
Purell is enough.
Hey,
I hear there are showers somewhere at WGBH, and I'm certainly going to test that theory when I get back, if I had gone in the water.
If you had gone in the water. Edgar B. Herrick III, the man swimming under the Curiosity Desk, theoretically.
Jim, before I go, let me tell you, we're going to be on Greater Boston with this story today, 7 o'clock on Channel 2. So check that out, and you might see for yourself whether or not I did or did not go in the water.
7 o'clock on Greater Boston with Emily Rooney. We'll find out the truth.
That's right.
About whether or not Edgar B. Herrick III did it. Edgar, great story. Thanks so much for calling in.
We may see him tonight in his hazmat suit.
What do you think of the odds?
And, of course, his flippers. Did he win in?
I think there's a chance.
I think there's a very good
chance.
That would be my guess, but we don't know for sure. Okay, when we come back, we're going to go over the running of the bulls. I think these people are absolutely crazy. Why do people go and get gored? That and other stories, including the naked athlete issue of ESPN's magazine. All that up next on Boston Public Radio.
Ron Isley has been a member of R&B royalty for more than half a century and inspired generations of fans.
You wouldn't believe how many people have came up and said, "I was born because of your record."
Ron Isley tells us about the good times and bad and gives us a taste of his new album, This Song Is For You. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you, and Citizens Bank, presenting sponsor of the Summer Arts Walks and Talks. Art and food and music in Back Bay are all a part of the Boston Summer Arts Weekend in late July. Info at bostonsummerarts.com. And Lewis and Clark follow the famed explorer's 19th century voyage from St. Louis to the Pacific, a journey filled with danger and discovery. Ken Burns' Lewis and Clark continues Tuesday at 8 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You know, these days in Boston, when you say sports, most people think, I don't know, of the Sox with the best record in baseball, Aaron Hernandez in a small cell, or the new man boy, whatever his name is, the coach of the Celtics. Not for us, though. For the next few minutes, we'll talk about naked bodies and bulls, specifically the body issue of ESPN magazine and the running of the bulls in Pamplona. We're going to do it with a sports enterprise and investigative reporter for the Boston Globe. She would be Shira Springer. Welcome back, Shira.
But before we get to the naked bodies and the bulls, what about...
Wait. We turn around and look who you will now see, if he did it, in his swimsuit, tussled hair, and towel.
A very wet Edgar B. Horrigan.
If he did it, we just don't know. But I'm sorry I interrupted you. Thank you.
But Shira, you swam in the Charles?
I have not swum in the Charles. I kayak in the Charles a lot. But I would swim in the Charles before I ran with the bulls in Pamplona. That's for sure.
Okay. All right. Well, I have long been fascinated by this whole running with the bulls.
I have actually considered doing it.
You have?
Yes.
But these people
like
get gored
wish.
All the time. Somebody got killed a few years ago. What is the fascination, the draw?
Well, for me, I was in high school. I think I had just read The Sun Also Rises.
Yes.
And, you know, I was sort of...
Way.
Yes, exactly. And I had this very romantic notion of running with the bulls. And then as I got a little bit older and learned a little bit more about the event, you realize... And I was a track runner, so I thought, I'll just outrun the bulls. And it was sort of a crazy notion in my own head. And I thought, I could do it. And then you realize that you're not really responsible for your own safety, that you've got about 1,000, you know, or 2,000 people who are just running with you, and it's just a crapshoot. You know, that's what it seems like to me. I mean, more than one person has died. I think the last death was in 2009, but I think over time, there have been 15 people killed at the event since 1924.
And by the way, I'm reading that this bull run is believed to date to the 13th century, but it has apparently continued virtually every year since 1592, and people thought to have joined the running of the bulls sometime in the 1800s. So I never, even though I find it thrilling from afar, what's the concept? I assume, I don't mean this is, everybody gets just wildly drunk, then puts on, you have to wear white and with a red scarf or something.
Exactly,
and because the red, the bull is attracted to the red.
And some people roll up newspapers so that they can kind of distract the bull, like the day's newspaper, so they can distract the bull away from
but
them.
But what's the point? Just to
have
risk in your life? Oh,
yeah,
is that
bucket
what it is?
List, okay. I think. I mean, ask Rex Ryan, because he did it twice this year.
I saw the headline. I thought that was a joke. The coach of the New York Jets?
The coach of the New York Jets. There is photographic and video evidence that he did indeed run twice. Not just once.
You know
twice.
Why I heard? I heard because he likes the hooves of bulls. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah. So when they want
to,
I think he was hoping for an easy escape from his job, and that seemed preferable to actually coaching the Jets.
But when do 1,000 people run at one time?
It looks like just a mass on these narrow, some cobblestone streets as you're skidding along.
So who ends up being right in front of the bulls?
I mean, the stupid people?
I guess. That's what you wonder. Like in the marathon,
the more
they line
drunk
people
up.
They just kind of all get there, and you might be in the back. And
yeah,
then you're
I understand it, there are different places that you can line up in sort of a general starting area. So you can choose to be. It's about a 900-yard run, and it takes roughly 4 to 5 minutes, depending on how quickly the bulls go and how quickly the masses of the people go. But my understanding is that there's sort of a general starting area, and you can line up a little bit, you know, maybe 100 yards or so away from the actual pen where they release the bulls. So you're not, you know, you'll experience the full thing, but you're not in the line of fire, so to speak, right away. And you have a little bit of a head start.
So when people end up getting gored, is this because the bulls are intentionally after them, or just because they're trying to shove them out of the way, or what's?
I think because the bulls are freaking out.
Okay.
That, you know, there are so many people clustered around them. You know, the bulls, I think if I was a bull, I'd just be trying to do my thing and get to the ring. You know, I mean, you just want to get from point A to B. I don't attribute a lot of intelligence to the bulls.
Right.
And I think just the mass of people screaming, from what I understand and what I've seen, there are people who are like, you know, drunk and, you know, shouting down from balconies, egging on the bulls, trying to really pump them up and get them angry. It doesn't take much to get a bull angry. So, you know, and a lot of the people who get gored, like this 23-year-old Australian woman who was seriously injured by being gored in the chest and, you know, underwent some pretty critical surgery to save her life. Seems to me like she was in the wrong place at the wrong time during a bull run.
I'm thinking of driving it next year. I'm going to see if they'll by the way, we're going to switch gears here. But if anybody has either done it or is even seriously contemplating it, please give us a buzz. 877-301-8970.
And I was just thinking, you know, if Rex Ryan did, I wondered, like, how would Bill Belichick approach this? I mean, could you see this? Like, how would he approach this? Would he, like, literally draw up a map of the course and, like, figure out what kind of, you know, how he, the best places to be?
Then he'd glare at the bulls and assume that they'd run in the other direction.
You know,
in any case,
black,
what people know a lot more about
and
a lot more people are willing to try is the body issue of ESPN magazine. Am I correct? Last year, was the tight end, was Gronkowski on the cover of this thing last year?
I believe he was with the Hulk myth.
Yeah, I think he was. So the body issue, I mean, tell people.
Something
else
I wouldn't do.
For some people,
swim in the Charles first.
For some people who, for those who don't know what it is, even though it's huge, what is the body issue? How long has it been around? That sort of thing.
I don't know how long it's been around. It seems like several years. But basically what ESPN does is it gets a number of fairly high profile athletes. And in this issue, there were some high profile, recognizable names. And then there were some sort of X Games athletes and extreme athletes, and basically ask them to pose nude. Now, some of them are in sort of modely poses, and some of them are in very sports-specific posters. So you'd have an NBA guard, perhaps, or an NBA forward dribbling a basketball or, you know, going up for a dunk while naked. And they strategically cover all the naughty parts, so they're not really exposed, but some might say it's tasteful nudity. It's you know, when it's done like that, but it's meant to be more artistic than it is to be graphic.
Do you remember? You just reminded me when they said they might have a ball covering an appropriate part. Do you remember when my friend Mark Ostow did the Cambridge calendar of naked famous Canterburgians, and Bob Reich, the former Secretary of Labor, is at Formaggio in West Cambridge, and he had a wheel of cheese covering his genitalia. It was pretty great. Now, there are some, I mean, the quarterback, I can't pronounce his name. What's the quarterback for the San Francisco
49ers? Colin Kaepernick?
The guy who's pretty heavily tattooed.
Yeah.
He's featured in this. Kerry Walsh Jennings, who was part of the celebrity team that won volleyball championships.
Three-time
beach volleyball.
Pregnant.
They have her pregnant and then post-pregnancy holding her baby naked in both situations.
I thought that was really cool.
I thought it was fab. Why do they say they do this, by the way? What's the allure?
I think for somebody like Kerry Walsh, it's kind of getting out of her comfort zone, showing a different side of herself, quite literally.
Colin Kaepernick,
same thing. I think, they kind of just want to take themselves out of the football realm. I mean, let's be honest, today athletes are all about branding themselves. And if you can get out of that narrow sports brand, you're doing well. For some of the X Game athletes, some of the athletes I'd never heard of, there's a funny car racer that's included. She's posing on a tire.
Yep.
I think it's just to get their name out there. I mean, there were at least a half dozen athletes I never knew of that I now know because I saw them posing in a body issue.
Well, you know what? I had such a different reaction to this than I thought I would because partly because there were men in there, too, and it wasn't just, let's look at these gorgeous, like, Playboy-type women or even
the swimsuit issue and stuff.
I mean, the swimsuit issue is fine, but when I looked at these women, they were so powerful and they were such great athletes. I looked at it, and I got to say, and then you look at the men, Vernon Davis, the other guy from the San Francisco 49ers. I mean, these people have incredible bodies, and they've got incredible muscles, and the women were really powerful, and I liked it. I thought I wouldn't, and I did.
Yeah, there was one woman, that I thought was, speaking of, it wasn't the sort of gratuitous nudity.
Yeah.
There was one woman who was a motocross rider.
Yeah.
And they had her naked on her bike, dirtied up the way she would be in a race. And I thought that was really cool. I'm all for seeing female athletes and athletic female bodies and male athletic female bodies if they're doing something sports specific.
And is that the reason Marjorie and I were talking about before? One of my favorite things that happens every year, I subscribe to Sports Illustrated. My most favorite part of the year is the week or 2 weeks after the swimsuit edition comes out, where every letter is somebody saying, cancel my subscription immediately, as if they didn't know it was coming. Almost nobody objects to this. I mean, I've been trolling around looking at this in the last couple of days. Is that because, one, it's not models, it's athletes? And two, it's because, I mean, I guess to a lesser degree, because most of them are doing a variation on what they do for a living. Is that why there's not an uproar over this thing?
Yeah, there's not an uproar. I saw there was one athlete who received some uproar.
Who?
And it was, I'm going to mispronounce her first name, but Radwanska is her last name. She's a tennis player from
Poland.
She
has dropped from her role as ambassador for a Catholic youth movement after she posed nude.
Yes.
And I didn't know. I just read about that this morning. Go ahead.
Exactly. I was going to say the objection to her wasn't, necessarily that she, did something so egregious and her pose was very provocative. In fact, she had one of the least provocative poses and sort of one of the lamest poses, if you ask me, sitting by a pool filled with tennis balls. But she had promoted herself. Her brand was this Catholic, upstanding Catholic citizen. She had a large, she's Polish, this large Catholic following in Poland. And a lot of the priests in Poland objected to this being the image for Catholic youth. So it was more of a religious objection than it was to a this is a bad picture objection.
Okay, so I invited a couple of minutes ago anybody who's either run with the Bulls in Pamplona or has thought about it to give us a buzz. Now we'll add to that list. If people have seen the body issue, what's your reaction to this? And we'd particularly like to hear from some women, because generally it is women who are most objecting to the swimsuit edition of Sports Illustrated. But I think this thing is
just boxer.
Terrific. Who is the boxer?
There was a female boxer.
Marlon
Esparza.
Esparza, yes.
Yeah. What about her? I didn't see that one.
She was just terrific. I mean, she's this really powerful young woman, great boxer. And they all talked about how weird it was. They all come down and they've got these little white bathrobes on. And, obviously they're not used to being naked in front of all these camera people. And they talked about their nervousness and stuff. But then they kind of get over it, I guess, after a couple of minutes. And the pictures are they're just really impressive. And she looked great boxing.
And she had her boxing gloves on. Yeah. It was very sport appropriate. But the best one, I think the one that might take the cake, just for one, for sheer nerve and sheer sort of shock value, Gary Player.
Oh,
77. I'm so glad you brought that former champion golfer.
One of the all-time great PGA
golfers. From South Africa, is that where he's from?
I believe so,
yeah.
And he is, you know, swinging a golf club. And I mean, you know, he's not the fittest human being.
He's pretty close.
But he's pretty close. He's got a full head of hair.
Yeah, that was great.
And it's like, wow. Well, that's the pictures, pretty damn impressive.
They do show pictures of him when he was younger. And,
yes.
And, he looked pretty darn good. And for 77, you say to yourself, wow, this
and
is
just
amazing.
The nerve and sort of the, you know, hey, I'm going to go out and do this. For the younger athletes, it took a lot of courage,
yeah.
I think, to get out there and pose for these photos. But at 77, to put yourself out there. And be like,
sure. Is any Boston athletes in this?
I think
audition?
Sydney LaRue had spent some time with the Boston Breakers.
Soccer.
Yeah,
person.
I'm pretty sure she was. I believe she was on the Boston Breakers roster for a period of time. If she still isn't,
she looked
there.
Great too. They all look great.
What was also fascinating
Partridge.
For me was
you feel like well you feel
Calm
like you
down.
Get well you say to yourself, I feel like such a slug. Look at these people. You feel like you have to go to
they're
the gym immediately.
But they're pro athletes.
I know,
or...
but you just it's just amazing to look at what a conditioned person can look like since we see so few of them. I haven't seen one in my recent memory in real life.
What was also fascinating, I found, was just you get a real good shot at all their tattoos and their body
the
art.
Tattoos are unbelievable.
Colin Kaepernick, I mean, I didn't realize how expansive his body
yeah,
art
but it
was.
Ends totally at his
yes.
breastbone. There's nothing
yes.
yeah.
on the front of
and
him
it's
from there down.
And it's all done in black ink, and it's very artistic. And clearly a lot of these athletes have really thought about how
well,
they've inked themselves up.
It's almost like where the shoulder pads would go. The,
yes.
The equipment that you wear
well,
as a football
player. Well,
he's
got full sleeves, and then he's got – exactly, like
yeah.
shoulder pads and sleeves.
Yeah.
In any case, our number is 877-301-8970. Apparently, a few of you, what a surprise, want to talk about the body issue of ESPN Magazine. Let's start with Stephen Cambridge. Your first was Shira Springer from the Boston Globe. Hey, Steve.
Oh, hey, guys. How are you?
Excellent.
Good. Hey, I haven't seen the body issue. I just want to point out, though, that Robert Reich had a bathing suit on.
No.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
is...
And it was important for us to point that out every time we mentioned it to somebody.
Wait, what's your connection
really?
To Reich, Steve?
I'm connected to CCTV, and
oh, okay.
I'm on their board.
CCTV, one of the greatest organizations, wins every award as the top local access station in the country virtually every single year. It was a fundraiser, I forgot, for CCTV, right?
It was, in following the movie that they did it. Yeah, I was Mr. December on my bike over in Fresh Pond.
Oh, my goodness.
Were you in a bathing suit, too?
No, I wasn't. I was naked, but I don't have any tattoos.
Okay.
Steve, thanks for the call. I have to say I was both offended and thrilled when, you know, they picked all these Canterbridgians. And when I first heard about it, because I know the photographer quite well and I wasn't picked, I'm saying, that is appalling. But
would
then
you have
the
done
flips,
it?
I would say no. I would say, considering, if you've seen, what's the name of the famous dancer who's Central Square based? I can't think of her name for a moment.
Famous dancer?
Oh, there's a hugely famous, I'll think of her name in a moment. Who? The photographs are staggering. They're beautiful,
uh-huh.
actually. And I'm a little disappointed that Reich was wearing a bathing suit, actually, but still a nice photo.
I think you could be right in there with Colin Kaepernick, whatever his name is, the quarterback.
Look at the smile on Marjorie's face. 877-301-8970. Let's get another one. Oh, wait a second. This guy, is this true? The guy actually ran with the Bulls, or is he selling us a bill of goods? Let's try him. Lou in Swansea, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Do you actually do this? Lou, do you actually do this?
Yes, I did this in 1967. My brother-in-law was birthing in Spain, and he was doing it. And I probably started halfway between the starting point, that is where the Bulls are let out of the pen, halfway to the arena. And then when you get in the arena... Then you just run around and irritate the Bulls and just stay out of their way.
How scared were you, Lou?
Excuse me?
How scared were you?
Scared was I?
Yeah.
I'm pretty scared, sure.
Yeah.
Why'd you do it, Lou?
Oh, testosterone, who knows? My brother-in-law was there, my wife was there, and if he was doing it, I was going to do it also.
Well, good for you. I mean, thank you for calling, Lou. I didn't think we'd find somebody, but apparently... We did. You know, somebody who is not posing in this issue. Any coaches in this issue, by the way? Or all players?
I think all players.
Yeah, speaking of coaches.
Rex Ryan would probably do it, though.
Oh, he probably would do it. We're told, are you doing something on the new man-boy coach of the Boston Celtics, 36-year-old Brad Stevens?
I am, yes.
What's going on with that?
Well, I went out to his hometown of Zionsville to kind of see his
origin
story. And Zionsville is about what you would think.
Where is it? Zionsville where?
Zionsville is about 17 miles northwest of Indianapolis.
Zionsville, okay.
Which is
Indiana.
Where Butler is, obviously.
It's,
where
yeah,
he
it's
took
about
to
25. Yep. Went
years.
To Hinkle Field House and checked out that whole area just to kind of get a sense of where this guy comes from. And I can safely say that it'll be quite a culture shock for him coming to Boston.
When is this running?
hopefully soon, sometime this week.
Before you go, we only have a few seconds. What is he like? I mean, what's your quick version of Brad Stevens? Can you tell us that?
Very Midwestern.
He is.
Very wholesome.
So, so in other words, he's in real trouble. Is that where you're...
I think it'll be interesting to see how he negotiates, you know... It might be a nice change, though, for some of the young Celtics to see kind of a much different personality.
Great.
A
sure Springer, thanks as always. We'll
Thank
look
you.
Forward to that piece. Thank you guys for listening. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Brian McGrory. He's the editor of the Boston Globe. And also, we promised you a Twinkie discussion today. We never quite got to it. We promise you we will return to Twinkies tomorrow. In the interim, you can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. On Twitter at BOS Public Radio. I'm at Jim Browdy. She's at Marjorie Egan. And I am Jim Browdy.
And I am Marjorie Egan.
We'll be back tomorrow at noon. Thanks so much for being here.